Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're going to start out with an article that is making the news and getting major hype and is completely, well, according to a critique that I listened to this morning by one of the most incisive statistical minds that I know, Dr. Patrick Sullivan here at Dominican Hospital, I have to tell you, I'm feeling a little bit skeptical about the editorial oversight at JAMA right now. This paper purports to reach some very important causal conclusions, but the technique that they're using is, to say the least, a stretch. So let's start out with the basics here. The article was published, June 15th, 2026, in JAMA Internal Medicine. That was the online publication. And I presume that it's out there somewhere in print to that precious few who, the proud, the brave, who actually subscribe still to the physical journal of JAMA Internal Medicine. But for the rest of us, we're stuck with the online copy. I want to start out by just giving you a little bit of background, and we're going to walk through how in so many ways this paper and its conclusions are stepping, well, let's just say, outside of what is valid statistical practice. And we might not have time to talk about all of the economic and, let's call them, sociological drivers for that. But let's start with the study, okay? So it's a natural experiment where something happens, and it happens on a certain date, and then we can look at the response, what happens after that date, does it change behavior? And so in this case, several years ago, the VA sent out a recommendation for people to get the flu and the COVID shot at the same time that fall, on the same visit. So there were a lot of people, people in this Veterans Administration archive who either did one or the other, got the flu shot or got the flu plus COVID shot. There's also a third group that wasn't looked like, which was the other millions of veterans who didn't do either one or didn't report it to the VA or get it through the VA. So we're not looking at the entire cohort. That's objection number one. So the people who went and got the flu plus the COVID shot, there were about
350,000.
And the people who went and got the flu shot, there were about
1,040,000
of them in this information cohort. And the authors at the end of this study point out that there was a modest reduction in heart events after the COVID-19 shot, but a substantially larger reduction in all-cause myocardial events in the people who didn't get COVID or had no diagnosis of COVID. And they infer from this that there's a hidden burden of COVID going on in the population, and it's having an adverse effect on the on people's heart attack rate. Because what else could it be, right? Could the data possibly be flawed? Well, the data does not here support cause and effect of some mysterious X factor that you're getting COVID vaccine magic or there's all these hidden factors here. The data suggests, Occam's razor suggests, that the groups were not comparable. So this is really about lying with statistics. First of all, the standard in statistics to make a claim like this would be if you had a placebo-controlled trial. Now, that's not what we have here. What they did was they took data and they went back and they massaged it to try to make it as if there had been a placebo-controlled trial. So they took retrospective information and tried to turn it into prospective information by tweaking all of the myriad factors that they could think of that might possibly make a difference and assigning a plus or a minus multiplier to try to equalize these two very unequal groups. The general premise of statistics, just in case you don't realize it, is that if you're studying the effect of something on a population, then you want to study the broadest population possible because you want the effect to be generalized to the general population. So we've kind of, you know, we're hitting ourselves with our hand in the forehead going, oh, wait, we did that research on men. Maybe we shouldn't have assumed that because that drug didn't work in men, it wouldn't work in women. And now we're having to go back and redo tons of studies because it turns out a woman is not just a lighter weight man. There are all sorts of different variables in the physiology, which any high schooler could have told you. But nevertheless, it's been a blind spot in science in terms of research, research funding, and population statistics. Another thing that's necessary to reach any kind of cause an associative conclusion is randomization. And this, by definition, was not a randomized study, okay? It wasn't just a group. It was people who decided to listen to the VA. Now, I will present to you that people who are going to do what the VA tells them to do may be people who are better enabled to do it. For example, there's a VA nearby. They are maybe people who are perhaps, for whatever reason, more likely to do what they're told, and that could be a factor. They could be people who are more health conscious and are like, oh, well, if I can do something for my health, I'm definitely going to do it, and the VA says do it. So, yeah, sure. And another issue here is this idea, what I call significant results. Now, significant in this phrase means there's statistical significance. So these results are statistically significant. There is a difference between the two groups. I'll get to why it doesn't make much sense later, but yes, there was a difference. And there's a large fallacy here in that it's not significant or meaningful clinically, okay? It isn't a big enough difference for you to really care about it. And so let's get into the number needed to treat. Now, remember, this is the statement they're saying here is that it reduces the cardiovascular disease. And let's see. The risk ratio is 2. Well, that sounds great until you actually look at the numbers. So if you flip that and you say, well, how many people would need to get the flu shot and the COVID shot together so that when they got COVID, they didn't get a heart attack? And the answer is 2 out of 10,000. You would prevent 2 out of 10,000. You have benefit to 2 out of 10,000. And that's statistically significant, but it's not clinically meaningful from a population statistic standpoint. If you looked at all people, in other words, the ones who weren't diagnosed with COVID, the number was 20 per 10,000, which is, you know, 2 per 1,000. And that starts to look like something meaningful from, you know, maybe a public health viewpoint, but clinically, it's still small potatoes.
But here's a really big, big flaw in this study. Remember, we started out with 1,040,000 in one group and 350,000 in the other? Well, guess what? The dropout rate in the first group, the million plus, was 20%.
So that means that people fell off the horizon, they changed their phone number, they didn't get back to the VA, they were lost to follow-up. Now, the rate, that's 20% dropout rate. In that other group, the ones who got the flu and the COVID who did what the VA said, the dropout rate in that group was 2%, which again goes to the idea that there's a fundamental difference here between these two groups in terms of their motivation, in terms of their follow through, some, you know, an X factor that's likely to, well, let's just say it's a second factor. And when you want to assign causality, if you've got an alternative explanation for that causality, that really weakens your study. And in this case, the dropout rates being so different is a big red flag. Another big red flag is when you look at the graphs that they present in this paper on the data, the decrease in heart attacks in both groups starts really early. And if this vaccine, if you get the COVID shot and the two groups, the ones that got the COVID shot and the ones that just got the flu shot, start diverging about a month afterwards, that defies logic. That's like, wait, that's just weird that the cardiac event rate is happening that quickly. And it suggests that, again, there's some other X factor here, maybe even dropout rates, but there's some other X factor here that is saying that this is not credible, not clinically credible. It may be statistically significant, but as a doctor, I'm looking at this going, I don't think that's the COVID shot doing that. I don't think it could work that quickly. And I'd love to see, you know, longer term data. So this study has been very difficult to analyze. It looks good on paper until you read it carefully, which my friend Patrick Sullivan did. And he's the sort of person who looks at the statistical formula and says, you know what? This just won't work. It isn't doing what it thinks it's doing, and it's not an appropriate application of it. But hey, it got published, and it is turning into support. It's just like when someone comes to me from the opposite end of this and they're like, oh, the vaccine, it does this. And I go and I look at the papers that show that ivermectin drastically reduces hospitalization rates in, a single cohort. Once you read, it's non-controlled, there's no placebo, it's in the middle of the COVID epidemic, and it's in a country whose data collection I don't really trust. So, yeah, okay, maybe. Well, now I'm going to do the same thing to this study, which I'm saying it doesn't actually prove what everybody is saying it proves. And it's like, but it's, let's just say this is the politically correct version of exaggerating the data. And I believe that it's part of the responsibility of physicians, and I would add medical journals, not to get political and to use strict standards of actual science and not allow for, you know, numeric hocus pocus, especially when multiple conclusions are just plain fishy and don't make a lot of sense. Okay, so now we're going to get a little bit of rant. This is directed at a pharmacy chain, large pharmacy chain. It's part of a vertical healthcare monopoly, and they go by their initials. In the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years, I've seen an increasing amount of dishonest behavior and various forms of slow walking. You could even call it harassment in the sense that it is deliberately making life difficult for physicians who have the nerve to order controlled substances at this pharmacy. I want to be clear that there is a burden to writing controlled prescriptions. And we'll go into some detail because I asked a pharmacist about exactly what they have to do. And Well, if we go back about 10 years, we had this opiate crisis, and it was created by big pharma, certain companies in particular, been shown, and I think I can say that without fear of contradiction, that they misrepresented the addictive nature of opiates, their opiate in particular, oxycodone. They made grants and presentations to various educational organizations that were responsible for educating doctors to teach doctors that it was okay to use opiates, that you didn't have to worry that they weren't really as addictive as they might have been taught. They introduced pain as the fifth vital sign, making it a constant sort of thing. People being asked, do you have pain? How bad is it? Not wait until the person asked for something for pain, but almost promote them asking for something to pain by constantly saying, do you have pain? I remember once I was on a rowboat in the Santa Monica Bay with my mom, and, you know, we weren't very far from shore, and she kept asking me if I was seasick. Are you seasick? Are you seasick? And yeah, I got seasick, but I think it was suggestion. Do you have pain? Do you have pain? See what I'm saying? So that created a huge cash cow. We had drug mills where doctors would just give prescription out of prescription. It had to be obvious to the pharmacies that filled these prescriptions that this was a pill mill, that the doctor was essentially selling these prescriptions. They didn't report it. They didn't rock the boat. Eventually, the axe fell, and a whole bunch of additional regulations were imposed on the pharmacies. Now, if you're running a business, you like to keep your overhead down. So keeping your overhead down means not having to do a bunch of extra paperwork. But I will make the point that this county is rapidly running out of pharmacies that aren't owned by this megacorp. And so I just want to share with you some of the tricks that have been played on my patients and me over the years here. One of them is I write a prescription for a person with a broken leg, a person who's just had back surgery. They go to the pharmacy to pick up their, you know, reasonable number of pills, 60 pills, and that's a 20-day supply of what they're going to need for their pain. And the pharmacy says, well, we don't have it. You don't have hydrocodone? You don't have oxycodone? You don't have it? Really? Honest? No, I don't think so. I think you don't have it on the premises because you've decided not to have it on the premises because you want to make it difficult for people in pain to get a medication that they need, that a licensed physician has ascertained using due diligence that they need it. Yeah, I think that's disingenuous. Another one is to say, well, a prior authorization is required for this. Sometimes they'll say, well, we don't have it yet. What was the one that happened last week? Oh, we need clarification from your doctor. What kind of clarification do you need? I've written this prescription. It's right there. It's legal. It's legitimate. There's nothing in the cures report to indicate that I overprescribe or that the patient overuses. And exactly what clarification did you need? Well, I called them, and they couldn't find the clarification. Then they said, well, a prior authorization is needed. So I told the patient, it's going to take a while. Maybe you should just pay for this yourself because it takes a while to get these prior authorizations back. And he said, oh, I'm Medicare. Medicare doesn't pay for this particular controlled substance. I've always been buying it. And why is he not getting it from his old pharmacy? Because now that old pharmacy is suddenly having a supply chain issue. And maybe everybody's having a supply chain issue, but I would like it if across the board we got the same reason from a bunch of different pharmacies rather than one of the top three excuses that I'm getting. Now let's talk about why they might be doing this. That's why I called the pharmacist. And we really are in a paperwork crisis that's been generated effectively to punish the bad actors who weren't doing the due diligence. Now the due diligence has turned into something really crazy. Let's start with hydrocodone. Hydrocodone used to be a class 3 drug. That meant you could actually give refills. Now it's a class 2, no refills. You can either give someone way more than you want to, like a couple hundred, so you don't have to write a prescription again for 4 or 5 months, or you can give them a small amount and go through the rather time-consuming process of writing these controlled substances prescription again. There's also something called legitimate needs. Their license is on the hook if they don't demonstrate that they have assessed legitimate needs. So, for example, if the prescription's coming from out of the area, it would be one reason that you would have to investigate and stop and run a report with the state website on their drug use. And the pharmacists are now being held responsible. And here's the real rub. And the big corporations have basically said, we don't want to take a chance. So we're just not going to do it. We'll make it so full of friction to use us for your pain meds that you'll go somewhere else, which burdens the small independent pharmacies. And hundreds of these small independent pharmacies have lost their licenses in the state of California in the last few years. Now, they used to be required every 2 years to submit a report that said, what did they get? What did they purchase? What did they dispense? And what do they have in stock? And they had to document, you know, that fell on the floor, that one got lost, that one was subtracted. Every 2 years. Now it's quarterly. That's a substantial paperwork boredom. They have to, as I said, all mishaps and wastage have to be documented at the time and submitted. And they're inspected every 6 to 12 months when they used to be inspected much less frequency. I believe that we have a moral obligation to meet our patients' needs with respect to pain control. I also believe that we have a moral obligation to avoid feeding addictions, and that is a difficult set of obligations. It has to be carefully balanced. I do not feel it is ethical for doctors or clinics to declare, primary care clinics in particular, oh, we don't write narcotics anymore. We're just going to give everybody gabapentin. I will point out that gabapentin is not shown scientifically to work for anything but nerve pain. And no, all pain is not nerve pain, even though pain travels through a nerve. So I guess you could say it's nerve pain. That's not what nerve pain is. Nerve pain is pain from a sick nerve, a nerve that is being squeezed, a nerve that is diseased. It is not the nerve that carries the signal from the broken back, from the broken leg or the arthritic back to the brain, which is where sensation turns into pain anyway. Okay, I'm going to get off of the soapbox now, but I am urging you to take your, if you can, if you are not already obligated to use the large chain pharmacies, support your local, and I would say fairly heroic, independent pharmacies who are a vanishing breed, and B, are going to be the only places that people who can get pain medications can get them promptly when they first need them. And this is just nuts, and it could be you who breaks your leg and is put in a cast, and your prescription is not honored. Time to get to some emails. First of all, I want to get back to the person who asked a question about Campo, and I believe it was a musculoskeletal issue that she was interested in. So I went and did that research that I promised. And when I looked, I think the drug she was talking about is in this paper referred to as Gosha Jingkigan, which is a traditional Japanese Kanpo medicine used clinically to treat muscle pain in Japan. And this article actually looked at its mechanism in cell culture. And what it showed was that this suppresses a particular kind of voltage-gated sodium channel that's involved in skeletal muscle contraction. The way muscle contraction works, a signal goes from the brain down the spinal column, synapses once, goes to a motor nerve, comes out of the spinal column and goes down the leg or into the arm. And this motor nerve eventually drops its neurotransmitter on a motor end plate, which is the motor end plate is basically just a sensor that's on the surface of the muscle. And when the motor end plate is stimulated, it will, by the neurotransmitter, it will activate the muscle, and the muscle will clamp down or hold more tone, higher tone, so be stiffer. And this compound actually changes the threshold for that. So it blocks the activation or the of the motor end plate somewhat. So it reduces aberrant activation. It's a muscle relaxant. And another use for these is in pain control. In Japan, it's used to treat low back pain. It's also used to treat numbness in the extremities. And it's reported in one study to work for chemotherapy and diabetic neuropathy. I was not aware of that when I spoke about this before, but this looks like a pretty solid data, so I wanted to follow up on that. Now, our next email comes from Nick in Washington State. And Nick writes, ask Dr. Don, woman crippled by Alzheimer's resumes lively conversation after psilocybin mushrooms unlocked her memory. Check out this article on goodnewsnetwork.com. I can't wait to try this remedy for my inability to instantly use the word that works. What do you think of the possibility this is not a real situation? Well, Nick, we've talked earlier in this program about the strict principles of proof in science, you know, the gold standard, sometimes not possible to do, but the placebo-controlled double-blind trial, if you're talking about a drug, is easy. In the case of something like psilocybin, what are we going to use for a placebo? It affects cognition. It gives people visions. It changes their perception. They're going to know whether they got a placebo or not. So essentially, we have to look for our evidence in other ways. And the thing that you gave me was what's called a case report. There are reasons to think that psilocybin could help with Alzheimer's. I'm going to list those first, and then we'll get to the study you asked about. There are plausible mechanisms. For example, we know from studies that are well-designed and generally accepted as valid that it increases neuroplasticity. In other words, the ability to destroy old connections and make new ones. We know that it also is anti-inflammatory, and the current, I would say, the version of what's causing Alzheimer's disease that is getting the most traction now in the community is that it is primarily an inflammatory process. Psilocybin is also known to increase neurotrophic factor. That's brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is also increased by exercise. It's one of the reasons that exercise is the best thing you can do to avoid dementia or prevent the progression of mild cognitive deficits into full-on dementia. And there are several placebo-controlled double-blind trials in progress. And I will say they are registered, which means they're taking comers, they're setting up their study. Nothing's published, no data out yet. But there are people really working on the science, so that's good. Now, when we come to the study that you talked about, this was a single woman in her 80s with a 10-year history of Alzheimer's. And during the last 5 years, she had basically really deteriorated. She would only speak in single syllables. She had chronic urinary continence. She had problems with swallowing. She had problems walking on her own. and very little spontaneous communication. So she was pretty much reduced to a lump on a log. So she got 5 grams of orally administered psilocybin containing mushrooms, something called the Enigma strain. I did not look that aspect up. And that was a pretty big dose, 5 grams. She got an acute phase where she got autonomic activation. She probably booted up her body temperature. She was sweating like crazy. And then she fell into a prolonged sleep-like state. And then about 19 hours after, she woke up and started making multiple sentences and talking about herself. I'm going to quote from the paper. Over subsequent days and weeks, functional improvements included restoration of urinary continence, improved ambulation, autonomous dressing, that means getting herself dressed, increased emotional responsiveness, sustained social interaction, contextual memory retrieval, preserved working memory for social context, in other words, remembering her daughter and what her name was, and spontaneous conversational engagement, none of which she was doing before. So this is a pretty significant improvement. There have been, and just continuing with the case, unfortunately, we don't have any real, her diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease was what we would call a clinical diagnosis. So she hadn't had the blood testing or the CSF fluid testing, and she hadn't had the advanced neuroimaging looking at the size of her hippocampus. So we don't know if she really had Alzheimer's or some other type of neurodegenerative disease or a combination of things. So how long did it last? Well, it lasted for several weeks after the first intervention. Everything was much better. 1 month after the initial session, she was still continent and she was still improved compared with baseline, but they gave her a second shot. She was probably, it does not say that here, she was probably deteriorating a little bit. So they gave her a second session using 3 grams. And this was associated with greater verbal expressivity, improved facial mimicry, spontaneous humor, emotionally valenced autobiographical imagery. In other words, remembering something that happened to her and telling a story. Actually, they did tell us what the story was. She remembered surfing with her son many years ago when he was young. And she also improved her walk. So she had relative persistence of some of the stuff, particularly the urinary incontinence. We're now 5 years out. And she's still better than she was at baseline. So we can say that something important changed in this particular case with the use of psilocybin and that it did improve the patient's quality of life. What we can't say was that she for sure had Alzheimer's disease, and we don't know whether there was a certain amount of bias on the part of the people around her who wanted to see her get better, so they kind of scored it differently. We would need a lot more data. So is it something you should do? Well, no. If your main problem is word finding, finding the word that works quickly, which is, I think, what you meant by your statement, the first thing I would do, Nick, is get yourself checked out by a heart doctor or by your primary care doctor, get a stress test, make sure that your heart is okay, and then start a graded exercise program. Exercise and sleep both are really important for cognition as we age. And the best thing you can do is not take some psilocybin from some halfway legitimate outfit that's located in Washington State. The best thing you can do is to kick up your exercise, particularly weightlifting, and make sure you get good sleep. That's going to do more for your cognition than any of the other things. Another email from Joseph in Capitola. Hello, Don. Our son was exposed to two types of mold, toxic. One of them was Aspergillus. There's some paraphrases in here. It was obviously a voice-to-text kind of email. And he was exposed to those at higher level. He then started having spasms and body control issues. It's been 34 years now that he's gained control of most of his body movement. He still has hypersensitivity to any toxic chemicals in the air, and we have to walk out of a room when exposed to them. My question is, we have thrown out 80% of the furniture in our apartment since he has since gotten better. We've had the place, we've had the walls treated, we've had behind the walls checked for mold, and cleaned the whole place with a mold cleanser, but he's still afraid to come back to our apartment. Is there anything you could say that would maybe make him feel more comfortable about returning? We have since got it checked and it seems safe, but he doesn't believe that. I've listened to you for years and appreciate all you do. Thanks for being a big, I don't know, it says a big place to the communities, but whatever it is, I think you're welcome. So what can you do? Well, the first thing is ERMI testing, which is environmental testing. I don't know if you've had this. It's ERMI. It's widely available. You want commercial testing, and you want them to go along the floor, along the molding on the floor in the rooms. So they run a Q-tip on there, and they do a mold count there, because that's going to have the highest amount of mold spores, and you want that number to be very low. The second thing you can do, and this is iffy, it could backfire, but maybe you should test both yourselves for mold toxin. If you're not going to a job site or another location every day and you're retired and mostly spending time, you have a son who's way over 34, so you probably are mostly living in your house and around the outside of your house. In that case, you could test your own urine for mold toxin levels. And if you were falling into the low range for the population, that means that your house is as clean as it's going to get. So negative ERMI testing and just saying, okay, my levels are low, your mother's levels are low, this is as good as it can be. Please come and spend time with your folks. And I sincerely hope that that works. We're going to do a news of the weird. This is a great weird one. This is about a tiny fly with giant sperm. All right. You've probably seen fruit flies, little Drosophila guys. They're pretty small. They're maybe 4 or 5 millimeters long. Well, in the natural selection process, making more babies that have your DNA is the name of the game. So fruit fly females mate with multiple partners in rapid succession, which means the sperm get to compete with rivals, not just with each other all carrying the same DNA, but with other rivals carrying different DNA to get to the egg. The biggest sperm can muscle out the others, so over the millennia, this fly has evolved giant sperm cells. These sperm can be even longer than the male's own 2-millimeter-long body. That would make them 40 times longer than a human sperm. And each male has thousands of them. Where does he put them, and how do they avoid a tangling up inside the fly? Well, to find out, researchers, I just love what the congressman, who's anti-science would do with this one. Researchers painted the sperm heads and tails with fluorescent dye and examined them under a 3D microscope. They found that fruit fly sperm are not wiggly like human sperm, but relatively chill and calm. In isolation, they move very little, and when packed inside the male fly's body, they move in sync, remaining taut so they don't curl up. The tail is moving just as quickly as the head, but the tails collectively move more slowly, in a slow, flowy churn. I'm thinking of like kelp in the tides, It's just sort of like, yeah, we're sperm, we're chilling, we're just rolling back and forth. And the researchers say the coordination is reminiscent of a flock of birds or a school of fish. Well, I'm going with kelp, actually, myself, in my mind. But, evolution finds a way. All right, here's a little bit scarier one, but I think still worth talking about. Millennials' rapid aging. People born in the 1990s are getting cancer earlier than their forebears. We've talked about how they've changed the date, the age for first colonoscopy down to 40, because we're seeing aggressive metastatic cancers in an age group that just rarely had them before. A new study suggests that this could be because their bodies are aging faster. Researchers at Washington University in St. Louis analyzed blood samples and health data from 154,000 people in the UK and 10,000 in the US, focusing on one cohort born in the 90s and another born three decades earlier. They determined the biological age based on nine blood biomarkers, then compared that result to the subject's actual chronological age. On a molecular level, the younger group appeared to be aging faster than the older, and the larger the gap between biological and chronological age, the higher the risk of cancers, including lung, colon, and uterine, all of which are rising in prevalence among younger people. The next step is to understand exactly what these measurements are telling us. One person, geneticist Jyoti Nangalia, who was not involved in the study, asks, are they capturing processes that directly drive cancer development, or are both these biological changes in cancer being driven by other shared underlying factors? Well, as a boomer, I would go with door number two, and for those of you who don't know what that means, ask ChatGPT. Another sort of biological story. The gut microbiome is essential for maintaining female fertility, according to a study in mice. This finding could inform treatments for infertility. This work was done by Sarah Munyoki at the University of Pennsylvania, and they looked at the breeding records of 493 litters of mice. I almost said liters of mice, which would be an interesting image. Some of the mice were germ-free, meaning that they had no microorganisms in their tissues. That's one of the things we do in lab testing, is we have these germ-free mice, and you can order them up and get a crate of germ-free mice. They've been raised, and they have essentially no microbiome. Control mice were actually mice with microbiota, but not those that could make the animals ill. So they had, let's call it, a healthy mouse microbiome, at least as healthy as it can be eating whatever the laboratories are feeding the mice, because your microbiome is drastically influenced by that, and that's probably not, let's just say, not the wild-type mice diet that they're getting. The authors found that the germ-free mice had a shorter reproductive lifespan and more ovarian scarring than the control animals. Germ-free mice also lost primordial follicles. These are structures that are present at birth that contain cells that can mature into fertilizable eggs. So you're born with a certain number of eggs, and you never really run out of eggs because there are so many. But if you're losing, but some of those eggs are going to be duds, and so losing primordial follicles is a pathological state. And they lost those much faster than the control counterparts. Then they introduced bacteria into the guts of germ-free mice, either at birth or at weaning, and they looked at them again. And this introduction of bacteria prevented ovarian scarring and slowed the loss of primordial follicles back down to the level that was seen in the mice that were the control mice. They also gave doses of microbial compounds called short-chain fatty acids to the germ-free mice. Butyrate and butyric acid are two, and acetate are short-chain fatty acids. They're derived through the fermentation of fiber. They are the thing that the gut microbiota make that is good for the colon, but it also apparently is good for the ovaries, because if you take those germ-free mice and you just give them these short-chain fatty acids, which cannot be produced in germ-free mice but are produced by the microbiome in mice that have them, they reversed the effects that they were seeing in terms of the ovarian deterioration. So you could say that the gut microbiome protects and nourishes those future egg cells. And you know, more research in this direction is certainly called for. But I'm going to take a leap here and say, since there's a readily available source of butyrate, a short-chain fatty acid, at your supermarket, that if you are female and are interested in preserving your fertility, perhaps you are in graduate school and aren't planning on a kid until 35, maybe you should take a tablespoon of ghee, G-H-E-E. It's clarified butter, and it's, like I said, available at the supermarket. Tastes a little different than regular butter, but you can use it in cooking, and that does not alter its properties. And it's healthy in a lot of bases for the colon, so the ovarian benefit is definitely theoretical, but, you know, falls into Dawn's favorite category of might help and won't hurt.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.